Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Pete Anderson. Today I'll be reading from the June 24th, 2024 edition of the Hartford Business Journal. The first story we're going to be looking at today is titled The NIL Era. It's subtitled, Here's an Inside Look at UConn's Name, Image, and Likeness Infrastructure and How It's Key to Recruiting, Compensating, and Educating Top Athletes. If you're a fan of UConn men's basketball, or you've even just casually paid attention to the team over the past 2 years, you probably know the name Donovan Clingan, a hard-to-miss 7-foot-2-inch center. Winning back-to-back NCAA titles, which Clingan did during his 2 seasons with the team before declaring for the NBA draft in April, makes you famous, but so does having your face on billboards and in TV ads. That hasn't always been the case for college athletes, who in the past were forbidden by NCAA rules from accepting money to represent businesses. That has changed, though, in the still-evolving landscape of collegiate sports in which we now live, the era of NIL, which allows student-athletes to earn money from their name, image, and likeness. Still, you likely don't know the names of people who helped UConn students-athletes navigate the nuances of NIL. Names like Jason Burkhofer and David Noble. Or those who help raise NIL money for the athletes, such as John Malfitone or Mark DeMelio. In the NIL era, which is only 3 years old, what they and others do to support the school's athletes is becoming as important as the work done by the coaches, particularly in helping UConn recruit top athletes to remain competitive on the field, court, or ice rink. Hartford Business Journal dove into the morass of NIL to understand how UConn competes on this new financial playing field, including a look on how much money is involved. The short answer is, no one will say, as well as where it comes from and where it goes. The most interesting revelation, though, is that UConn officials view NIL not just as a chance for lucrative payday for some athletes, but as an opportunity to learn about business and life. Butkoffer's official title at UConn is Deputy Director of Athletics / Chief Operating Officer. He does a number of things, from leading ticket operations and sales to overseeing the National C Club, which supports former UConn athletes and managers. But Butkoffer, who previously served as Deputy Director of Athletics at both Purdue University and the University of Washington, was hired in June 2022 by Athletic Director David Benedict for another explicit purpose. David originally brought me here with the priority being getting the structure and strategy set for our NIL program, Butkoffer said. We've launched and we've grown from there. NIL officially launched on July 1st, 2021, when the NCAA created an interim policy allowing athletes to earn money from their name, image, and likeness. Since then, there has been numerous updates, revisions, lawsuits, and court decisions that continue to reshape what schools and athletes can and cannot do. Asked about the shifting NIL landscape, Butkoffer said it creates anxiety for everyone. It's like a moving target and things are constantly changing, he said. So it kind of feels like the plane's being built as it's being flown. Eric Brown, a Watertown labor and employment attorney who counsels college athletes, said NIL has undergone a rapid evolution. In its first year, schools initially took a hands-off approach out of fear of NCAA sanctions, which left athletes on their own trying to find promotional opportunities that often were minimal, maybe 10 or 15 bucks for social media posts or free merchandise, he said. So you've got these nationally known athletes getting a pittance, and the colleges weren't doing a heck of a lot to support it, Brown said. They weren't training these kids on what they could do, what their opportunities could be. UConn, however, was determined to set a foundation that would tether education and personal and professional growth with the NIL journey, Butkoffer said. To do that, the university turned to Wirth Institute for Entrepreneurship and Innovation, which was founded in 2017 with a $22.5 million gift from philanthropist and entrepreneur Peter Wirth. The Institute launched Championship Labs in 2022 to provide student-athletes entrepreneurial support as they now can earn money by creating and promoting their own brand and selling merchandise across social media, which can mean selling autographed jerseys on TikTok or Instagram, or doing their own sponsored podcasts, or by signing contracts to promote existing brands and businesses. Wirth Institute Director David Noble said Championship Labs provides counsels on topics that range from the best practices on social media to experimenting behind or in front of the camera to launch a clothing line or whatever a student can dream up. Benedict, UConn's athletic director, said Championship Labs' role is critical. What the Wirth Institute does through Championship Labs is really a big piece of supporting our student athletes on a daily basis, he said. While getting the Wirth Institute, which also serves regular students, involved was important, UConn still had to develop a strategy for raising money for its athletes. Butkoffer said the NIL landscape includes three buckets. The first involves collectives, organizations independent from the university that raise money, including from businesses and wealthy donors to compensate athletes. The second bucket involves the more traditional brand deals, in which athletes sign agreements to be paid to promote a brand or a business. The third bucket is group licensing, which involves athletes who pool their NIL rights and then license them for compensation as a group. Butkoffer said schools are prohibited from acting on behalf of a specific athlete. We can't act as their agent, he said. We can't negotiate contracts for them. Schools also have limited say over the contracts athletes sign. They can set institutional policies to protect their own brands, which includes prohibiting athletes from promoting gambling, alcohol, tobacco, or marijuana. I think the only space that we really have to navigate at this point is brewery, Butkoffer said. Is a restaurant, or are they just producing beer? Connecticut joined several other states in passing its own NIL law in July 2021. It requires athletes to disclose to the school any NIL activity that results in compensation within 10 days. Sometimes we know about the deals that are happening weeks in advance. Sometimes we found out a couple of days before, Butkoffer said, but we've had no issues. While athletes, coaches, and administrators can all utilize the expertise of the school's two compliance officers, keeping track of each individual athlete's deals can be difficult. So like many NCAA institutions, UConn contracts would Open Doors Marketplace in NIL platform. Open Doors, Benedict said, allows athletes to build profile pages, enabling fans seeking autographed jerseys or businesses seeking athletes for promotional events to find them. It also serves as a business-to-business application, he said, noting that it can handle payments and record transactions, which is ultimately important from a reporting standpoint for a lot of reasons. Benedict said the platform also can generate a 1099 tax form used by independent contractors to report income to the IRS. The money, of course, is the root of NIL. The whole point is to allow student athletes to monetize their names and faces. And make no mistake, the money can be significant. In February, college sports media and data company On3 reported that NIL collectives and schools in the major conferences are projected to spend about $325 million over the next 12 months on name, image, and likeness efforts. While the specifics of NIL deals are generally not disclosed, they are not subject to the Freedom of Information laws. Information about their value sometimes leaks out. For example, ESPN reported in May that former Utah basketball star Great Ozabor transferred to the University of Washington in part because of a $2 million NIL deal. Butkoffer stated unequivocally that other than scholarships, none of the UConn's athletic budget can be used to pay athletes. It would be difficult for the institution to take out that cost given that UConn Athletics continues to run a deficit. $30.2 million in 2023, down from $53 million in 2022. But Coffer also said NIL funds are not intended to be used to pay recruits. Money raised by outside organizations, however, can compensate athletes for things like participating in teaching camps or visiting schools or hospitals. That's where the collectives come in. There are two that raise money for UConn, include Bleeding Blue for Good, a 501c3 nonprofit that was co-founded 2 years ago by alums John Malfitone, a former private equity executive who also worked at GE Capital and KPMG, and John Greenblatt, who previously served as interim CEO of the UConn Foundation, the school's charitable arm. Malfitone, who serves as president of Bleeding Blue, said he and Greenblatt did not want to raise money just to pay athletes. They also want to help them learn something. That's why we combined it with a 501c3, he said. The athletes only get paid when they do some charitable work. It's not just benefiting the athletes financially, it's benefiting them in terms of their understanding of what it means to be a role model. Bleeding Blue Executive Director Jared Thomas, a former Army officer with a law degree, said it's also important for businesses to see there can be a strong return on their investment when they contribute to NIL. He cited a charitable effort in the past year on behalf of the Connecticut Red Cross, which was conducting a blood drive and had just 12 people signed up to donate. Once Bleeding Blue agreed to have men's and women's basketball players attend to sign autographs and take photos with donors, within 12 hours every single slot was filled. Unlike for-profit businesses, which have marketing budgets to compensate athletes for appearances, Bleeding Blue paid UConn athletes on behalf of the Red Cross, which Thomas said is essentially an in-kind donation to the nonprofit organization. He declined, however, to say how much money Bleeding Blue has raised and paid to UConn athletes over its 2 years. Thomas did say his organization spends 10% or less of the money raised to cover its expenses, in part because he is the collective's only paid employee. According to Bleeding Blue's 900 tax form filed with the IRS, the organization in 2022 reported $579,204 in revenue from grants and contributions. It also disclosed $523,534 in expenditures, including $181,500 paid to Ohio-based ProCamps, an event management and sports marketing company, and $165,375 paid to Opendoors, the NIL marketplace platform used by UConn. Bleeding Blue has partnered with ProCamps on hosting basketball camps around the state that have featured UConn players. Bleeding Blue, at the end of 2022, listed $86,398 in assets and $30,728 in liabilities. In addition to Bleeding Blue, there is also the D'Amelio Huskies Collective, founded as a for-profit entity by UConn alum Mark D'Amelio, who has a background in the apparel industry. His collective also was formed as a way to educate UConn athletes, though with a focus on brand building. D'Amelio, whose daughters Charlie and Dixie are social media influencers, founded Mad Soul Clothing Company in 2000 and sold it 6 years later to former NFL player Drew Pearson. He and Pearson later founded Level 4 Collective, which represents licensed apparel companies, including Mitchell and Ness, owner of throwback sports jersey licenses for former players like Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. With that background and business knowledge, D'Amelio believes he was well-suited to help college athletes understand the business of branding. "For me, it's never been just about trying to stockpile money," he said. While the educational aspects of NIL won't change for UConn, the business landscape of college sports is expected to shift again in a major way. In May, the NCAA reached a $2.8 billion settlement agreement with former college athletes who had filed an antitrust class action lawsuit demanding compensation that had been denied to them. A judge still has to approve the deal. A condition of the settlement would permit school athletic departments to directly share revenue from ticket sales and TV contracts with athletes. It sets the amount to be shared at 22% of that revenue to start roughly more than $20 million annually per school. It's starting to look like rather than using NIL money to retain athletes and give them some spending money, it will be used to recruit athletes, said Brown, the labor attorney. Schools being allowed to pay athletes could put smaller colleges and conferences that don't demand the largest TV contracts, like UConn, which plays in the Big East, a non-Power 5 conference, at a competitive disadvantage. But Benedict, UConn's athletic director, says there's always been an uneven playing field between college sports programs. Before, it was facilities that schools would compete over, and then it was all the additional things, he said. It's how you travel and how much swag you give them. So there's always been this effort and competitiveness with trying to keep up with your peers and your competitors. He added that, in his opinion, NIL is going to probably die down or be eliminated once you get to a place where there's revenue sharing. Turning now to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This is titled, Amid Decarbonization Efforts, New England's Energy Demand Expected to Increase 23% Over the Next Decade. New England's energy demand is expected to increase 23% over the next decade, the head of the region's largest power generator association said at its annual energy conference earlier this month, and stakeholders in the region should focus on utility reliability and affordability as decarbonization efforts continue. New England Power Generators Association President Dan Dolan, during the Connecticut Business and Industry Association's 2024 Energy and Environment Conference, gave an overview of the region's power generation outlook and what Northeast states need to do in the coming years as the country continues to hone in on renewable and clean energy alternatives. He said there is an incredible economic opportunity in the energy sector, and investments must be made to meet the region's future needs. Demand is coming. We see a really constant rise over time, Dolan said, of energy usage over the next 10 years, which will be driven by the accelerating electrification of heating systems and transportation. Energy efficiency is great, but we're going to need to produce a whole lot more. New England is responsible for 2.8% of all carbon dioxide emissions in the United States, Dolan said, and much of the region's energy policy is driven by decarbonization. Most of those emissions are from commercial and retail heating and transportation, he said, and opportunistic electrification in the transportation and heating industry can help the region continue its focus on renewable energy. However, that will also drive up energy demand. To meet those needs, decarbonization must be a multifaceted effort, he said. While alternative energy options like solar and wind have had a lot of time in the spotlight recently, Dolan emphasized the need to continue to support clean energy sources like hydro and nuclear as decarbonization efforts grow over the next several years. We need every ounce of the clean energy that is on the planning board right now and that we need to expect to continue to be financed and developed. But we also need to preserve nearly all of the assets that serve as the backbone of the system, Dolan said. In 2023, 49% of the region's energy supply came from natural gas, 20% from nuclear, 8% from hydro, 10% from renewables such as wind and solar, and 13% net imports, according to new data from ISO New England. Notably absent from the list are coal and oil, which contributed far less than 0.5% of megawatt hours in the region in 2023. That is a dramatic shift over the last 15 to 20 years that has created remarkable emissions benefits for the region, Dolan said. At the CBIA event, ISO New England's lead state policy advisor for external affairs, Kerry Schlichting, gave an overview of the region's future expected power grid breakdown. According to projections from ISO New England, the total energy production breakdown in 2040 will be 56% renewables, 13% from nuclear, 12% from natural gas, 3% from hydro, and 16% from imports. No electricity is expected to come from coal or oil by then, she said. Dolan said, ultimately, decarbonization efforts needs to be a national effort, but states like Connecticut and the New England as a region can help lead. I remain hugely optimistic that we are going to find our way through this, but getting to those three legs of the stool, reliability, affordability, and decarbonization, we can do two out of the three of those pretty directly and easily. The real challenge is doing all these three things at once, Dolan said. Our next story from the Hartford Business Journal is titled, Senator Needleman Says Green Monster Tag Helped Sink Climate Change Bill During Legislative Session. A group of legislators at an annual energy conference said keeping energy affordable and reliable for Connecticut businesses should be paramount as state shifts to renewable and clean alternatives. The Connecticut Business and Industry Association earlier this month hosted its annual Energy and Environment Conference with a full agenda of experts and state officials giving their takes on topics ranging from solar, wind, and nuclear power to the state's electric grid. State Representative Patrick Callahan, a Republican from New Fairfield, Senator Ryan Fazio, a Republican from Greenwich, Representative Joe Gresko, a Democrat from Stratford, and Senator Norman Needleman, a Democrat from Essex, spoke on a panel to recap that last legislative session and how Connecticut's climate and energy goals had developed. Much of the conversation revolved around what Needleman deemed as a three-legged stool when it comes to energy: affordability, reliability, and climate change mitigation. We have to keep that balance. We have to be thoughtful, said Needleman, co-chair of the legislature's Energy and Technology Committee and a business owner who founded a Connecticut-based contract manufacturer. Affordable energy is key to sustaining a healthy economic base in Connecticut, Fazio said. Connecticut is still trying to bolster its manufacturing base, which has dwindled in recent decades, and energy prices are a significant cost in the state. When you talk to those manufacturers and businesses, the high cost of electricity is a major sticking point about investing in Connecticut, Fazio said. And it might not be realistic to decrease electric rates by 20% over the next decade, but at least we have to do everything possible to stop them from increasing 20 or 40 or 60% in the future. Fazio said it should be an above-all strategy when it comes to clean energy generation, including solar, wind, and hydropower. Natural gas and nuclear energy are key to a reliable energy grid, he said, so these options shouldn't be ignored either. Gresko also said a diversified energy portfolio is the way to go. The state needs to incentivize growth in the energy sector to let the market know that Connecticut is serious, he said. But Callahan said he has concerns about the reliability of both wind and solar power and the affordability of wind. I want reliable, not intermittent power, Callahan said. House Bill 5004, a high-profile proposal that would have declared a climate crisis and implemented several climate change-related measures statewide, including a commitment to reduce greenhouse gases over the next 25 years, died in the state Senate this session after being voted out of the House. While Governor Ned Lamont said the proposal will most likely not be included in a special session scheduled for this week, legislators said they expect the bill to be back next year. I don't think it goes away, Gresko said, while citing the fruitful conversations that happen while negotiating and debating the bill. As much as we would like to see CBIA come out in favor of the bill, I think it was an accomplishment that you were kind of neutral on it, and you saw it as more of an incentive package rather than mandates that the state puts on energy-generating companies. So I still think there's room for this bill to make it through the legislature in some form. Callahan, the new Fairfield GOP House member, said he couldn't vote for the bill last session because it would have led to higher energy rates, according to an analysis from the nonpartisan Office of Fiscal Analysis. But Needleman, the Democratic senator from Essex, said he thinks House Bill 5004 was mostly impacted by the Green Monster, nickname given by opponents. He said he also expects some iteration of the bill to be back in the future. 5004 probably suffered as much from just the title, the Green Monster. It was not, Needleman said. I think it was just the calendar that ran against us as things got down to the wire. The Yankee Institute, a conservative think tank, called the original version of the bill the Green Monster that would have placed additional costs on state government and businesses. The bill required state agencies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 45% from 2001 levels by 2030, 75% from 2016 levels by 2040, and to achieve net zero by 2050. Statewide, the bill required greenhouse gas emission levels 65% below 2001 levels by 2040. It also required the state to achieve economy-wide net zero emissions by 2050. Some of those provisions were removed by the bill late in the legislative session to broaden support for it. That still wasn't enough to get the legislation passed. Fazio, the Greenwich Senate Republican, said that any legislative proposal that could increase Connecticut's energy costs will receive pushback both from the residents and members of the General Assembly. I think the Green Monster, ending up as the Green Muppet, is probably because the public understands how costly energy bills are in Connecticut already, and electricity is already, and that we are up against a future reliability problem on top of it all, Fazio said. Needleman said the state's long-term clean energy goals are ultimately about the health of Connecticut's climate and people. I'm not a gung-ho advocate for phasing out fossil fuels tomorrow, but over the next 30, 40, 50 years, I hope we can all see that fossil fuels need to be phased out, and we need to continue to innovate and be creative, Needleman said. There are costs, but there are costs to not doing it. Well, that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the June 24th, 2024 edition of the Hartford Business Journal. I'm Pete Anderson. So long until next time.